come on a journey with a cinephile.
Wake up, sucker. We're thieves and we're bad guys. That's exactly what we are.
We was getting too big for our bitches.
Excellent day for an exorcism.
What have you done to its eyes?
I said, I'm not gonna hurt you. I'm just gonna bash your brains in.
What's your favorite scary movie?
Biddy well, little brother. Biddy well.
Hello and welcome, listeners, to episode 168 of Journey with a Cinephile, a horror movie podcast. As always, I'm your tour guide here of David Garrett Jr., recording out of Columbus, Ohio. So I'm not officially back on track as of yet, but I'm at least recording this intro the day that this episode was supposed to come out. So we will see when the episode itself actually gets released, but you know, I'm doing my best. So thank you so much for listening. I will just say that there. For this episode here, going to be my new year, new movie number 13, as the movie that was selected by the randomizer was Rituals, which will be my second feature review on here. And the first one is actually going to be The Offering. This is going to be the... It's a 2022 film, according to IMDb, but getting its wide release here in 2023. And then on top of that, I have some mini reviews for you of Skinamarink. I think that's how you say that. I also have Son of Kong as I continue with my Traverse Through the Threes. And then I also got to watch Pumpkinhead and Quieten. So I don't think there's anything else I need to get you up to speed with here for this intro. So once again, I've already said thank you. So I hope you enjoy coming on this journey with me.
Journey with a Cinephile.
For my first mini review is going to be Skinamarink. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but this is from 2022, but it's getting its wide release here in 2023. This was written and directed by Kyle Edward Bell, stars Jamie Hill, Lucas Paul, and Ross Paul. This is a horror film that is from Canada. It is currently sitting on a 5.4 on IMDb and a 3.1 on Letterboxd, with a synopsis being, two children wake up in the middle of the night to find their father is missing and all the windows and doors in their home have vanished. So this is a movie that caught my attention when the trailer was playing while I was at the Gateway Film Center. I don't normally watch trailers. There were things that I heard when this was playing that drew my attention, though. When I saw that this was actually coming to the Gateway, I made it a point to check it out and figured this wouldn't be showing long. This is one that I came in as blind as I could. So this movie is quite avant-garde. The director did interesting things with the camera work. The angles are of things that are up high or low. Things are out of focus. And we don't get a traditional like way of seeing our characters and framing them. This is partially why this movie is actually hard to talk about. What we are seeing is late at night and it's pretty dark. It also feels like they're filming this on a video camera, so it's, you know, snowy with like tracking and stuff, as well as a bit disordered. This is all adds to the odd atmosphere this movie has. So already this is a polarizing film from what I've seen. What makes this work for me though is a bit of nostalgia. It took me back to my sister and I staying up late watching old cartoons. My dad had a couple of VHS tapes with them recorded. They were always one from before us being born. I'm not even entirely sure how or where they were recorded from. Regardless, we would watch them over and over as we stayed up as late as we could. This brings in an irrational fear of something evil being in the dark, which I was scared of at that age. The last part of that I've brought up doesn't happen until late in the movie. The doors and windows disappear early on. The kids are there, you know, just having snacks and watching television. It is as the night goes on that things seem to have like a sinister entity around them. there's a dark, scary voice. Then the character of Kevin seems to end up being isolated as well, as Kevin being portrayed by Lucas Paul. It is a scary idea to be up by yourself, being afraid and not being able to find your parents as well. Now, I acknowledge I projected these ideas onto the movie. It is something that I connected with, so I can see why others who don't have this connection wouldn't like it. So, since we don't see our characters, it's hard to give them praise for their acting. The voices of everyone is good, so I'll give credit to, you know, Jamie Hill as the mom, Lucas Paul and Ross Paul as Kevin and Dad, respectively. Then we also have Dolly Rose Tetronall, who plays the younger Kaylee as well. I thought she was adorable with how her voice sounded. The only other thing I can do here would be the filmmaking to go over. The cinematography is interesting in what they do. I'll give credit. It does make it hard to give a normal narrative, though. There aren't much in the way of effects, but what we do seem to be done in camera, and I did enjoy that. The soundtrack works for, you know, being diegetic. It has come from the world of the movie mostly. There is this sound of static, which is unnerving. We also get that deep, scary voice of the entity. That worked quite well for me. So in conclusion, this is a hard movie to talk about. We don't get a normal narrative. This is quite experimental. I liked it to an extent, as it is uncomfortable. I also had a hard time following things as well. This is more of a movie that you do experience, and I'm glad that I got to in the theater. It would actually make an interesting double feature with something like Mad God. I can't recommend this to everybody, though. The art house crowd might get something from this. I would say give it a chance, especially if you're intrigued. But my rating here for Skinamarink is a 6 out of 10. Then up next, I have my old Traverse of the Threes movie, and that's going to be Son of Kong. This is from 1933, directed by Ernest B. Shodashak. This was written by Ruth Rose. It stars Robert Armstrong, Helen Mack, and Frank Riker. This is an adventure family horror sci-fi film that is from the United States. Currently sitting on a 5.6 on IMDb and a 2.6 on Letterboxd, with a synopsis being, the showman who brought Kong to New York returns to Skull Island and finds Kong's son a spunky 12-footer with winning personality and his dad's awesome strength. So this is a movie that I saw once quite a bit ago. I think it might have been in college or just after. I decided to give it a rewatch, as I was saying, for my Traverse to the Threes, and it was one that also intrigued me since I didn't remember much about it. So this one picks up right where the last one left off. Carl, who is portrayed by Armstrong, is being sued for what happened with Kong, so he's lying low. He doesn't have money, and if he goes outside, he's going to be served for being sued. His way out is in a form of a captain to the ship that brought Kong to New York, and that would be Captain Engelhorn, portrayed by Riker. I thought this was an interesting setup to get us out of New York and back to the exotic locations. Now, speaking of those, I like that we get more of that and what we got from King Kong on Skull Island. There are the natives, once again led by Noble Johnson. They chase them off the beach, which forces our group to find a cave that their boat can navigate into. Now, from there, we get stop motion to bring the Son of Kong to life. Not only that, we get more dinosaurs and other larger creatures. If anything, I could have used more of that. I get why we don't, though. Stop motion wasn't easy, and they probably didn't have a lot of ideas. I did want to give credit to the effects, though. They looked, for the time, great, and I have a soft spot for it. Now, where I want to go next would be talking a bit more about our characters. Carl is once again a good guy. He's also just trying to find a way to make money. I like that him and Captain Engelhorn as our like buddy duo. This one also adds an interesting love interest for Carl. I'm not entirely sure if he's coming onto Hilda romantically or if he's just trying to look out for like a father figure. Now, she's portrayed by Mac. Regardless, I don't mind her as the female lead. Then we also have Captain Niels Hellstrom, portrayed by John Marston. Now, this is kind of interesting because he works as our villain. He's just a scoundrel, thief, and a drunk, and actually the same guy who supposedly gave the map to Carl or told him how to get to Skull Island. So I think that's kind of a cool callback to bring into here. Now, since I described our characters, I'll go over to the acting. Armstrong is good as our lead. They don't do much with developing his character, but this is also early into cinema, so I can be forgiving. He's just a good guy, though, in general. Mac is good as our new woman. Riker, Brady, and the rest of the characters on the ship are solid, and I should say that Brady is Ed Brady, portraying Red. Now, Marston does well as our villain of sorts. Other than that, I like they bring back Victor Wong, as well as Johnson, as some of the other natives as well. Now, there's not much more to go into here, so I will go over to the filmmaking. I think the cinematography is fine. They don't do much with changing of the angles or movement, but that is the time. I did like the exotic locations again, though. That gives a sense of adventure that I enjoyed. Other than that, I'd say the soundtrack fit for what was needed without necessarily standing out. And then in conclusion here, this is a fine follow-up to a classic. I like what they do to progress our story. It feels logical. The continuing with Carl is a good route to take. I think that the characters they brought back are good, along with new ones they introduced. The stop-motion effects are solid. The exotic locations are interesting. I'm not sure if this does a lot to set itself apart. It is just a well-made movie that is trying to fill big shoes. If you like the original, I'd say give this a watch, and you can almost watch these back-to-back because they flow so well together. So my rating here for Son of Kong is going to be a 7 out of 10. And then up next I have Pumpkinhead. This is from 1988. This was directed by Stan Winston. This was written between Mark Patrick Carducci as well as Stan Winston. And then it also looks like Gary Girani helped out with this as well. And I should also say that Ed Justin wrote the poem. This stars Lance Hendrickson, Jeff East, and John DiAquino. This is a fantasy horror film that is from the United States. It is currently sitting on a 6.2 on IMDb and a 3.2 on Letterboxd, with our synopsis here being, after a tragic accident, a man conjures up a towering, vengeful demon called Pumpkinhead to destroy a group of unsuspecting teenagers. So it's a movie that I know I saw it back when I was in high school. To be honest, I didn't remember a lot aside from how cool the monster is and looks. This is part of the Summer Challenge series, so I was watching this in preparation. I was also curious to give it a rewatch after all of these years to kind of see, you know, if I remembered anything and where I sat with this movie. So this is an interesting story that we've seen before, though. It's a revenge one. I forgot that this is based on a poem originally, or at least the basic idea behind this entity. I'm intrigued to check that out now. What I also remembered when starting this up was that Stan Winston, the great effects master, was the director. That makes sense for actors and people that are behind the screen for sure. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things that feels to me like because he's such a presence, they wanted to work on this movie. So I want to start with our lead, Ed, portrayed by Hendrickson. He's great here. He is a small town guy. He knew tragedy with what happened to his wife. It seems like he's living a good life with his son of Billy, who is portrayed by Matthew Hurley. That is until the boy is struck while he's away. This is a heartbreaking in the sense that it's a perfect sum of events. Ed is away getting the feed that he forgot. Now we have Joel, who is portrayed by DiAquino. He's a jerk. He's been busted for drinking and driving, but still hasn't learned his lesson. He's afraid that if they take the boy to the hospital, it'll end his life. To be honest, if you are that callous of a human being, then you deserve to go to prison. I also can't blame Ed for his decision to go to the Witch of Haggis, portrayed by Florence Scheffler. So that's what I want to shift over to. This is a cautionary tale of revenge. In his snap judgment, Ed wants them to be punished. I like the idea that the pain Pumpkinhead inflicts is also felt by Ed. He also cannot just kill the creature to stop it. They're connected. I love the allegory here about what revenge does to people. Again, it isn't a new idea or one that we haven't seen like this before. I like what they do with it, though. Now, Pumpkinhead is a great character. I can see why that is the name that is given to this entity. The head does look similar to a pumpkin. I'm glad that someone like Winston is the director here, since he does seem like he focuses on making sure the creature looks great. The practical effects used are just that. Probably the strongest part of the movie, to be honest. I'll pull in another filmmaking aspect in here, which would be the cinematography. They do well in framing it to hide the seams as well. I like the surreal feel that we get when Ed is experiencing, you know, the killing. They do things with colored lights. It's edited well. I just wanted to give credit to all these aspects. So the last things to go into here would be with the acting. I've already said that Hendrickson is good. I also thought that DiAquino plays the jerk well. My issue with his performance is the change of character they try to have him have at the climax when things, you know, start ramping up. It just feels a bit out of place for what they were working toward. So I'd also say then that Jeff East, Kimberly Ross, Joel Huffman, Cynthia Bain, and Carrie Remsen, thought they were all solid as this group that gets revenge visited upon them. Scheffler was good as the witch. I like seeing cameos by Brian Bremer, George Buckflower, and we even have a young Mayim Bialik. Now, the acting here is solid across the board. So in conclusion, this is one that I'm glad that I finally got to watch and fully take in. We're getting a story that we've seen before of someone being wronged and then wanting revenge. What I like about this is they're showing that the heavy price this has on someone who's seeking it. Heinrichsen is good as our lead. The rest of the cast push him to where he ends up. True Star are the effects to bring Pumpkinhead to life. I'd say this is one of the better creature features out there. It has a bit more on the bone, which I appreciate. I'd recommend watching this one for sure, or at least give it a rewatch if it's been some time. So my rating here for Pumpkinhead is going to be an 8 out of 10. And then for my last mini review on this episode is going to be Kwaiden. This is from 1964. This is directed by Masakai Kobayashi. This was written by Yoko Mizuki. And I believe this is also based on the novel from Lafcadio Hearn. Now, this is starring Rentaro Mikuni, Michio Aratama, and Misaku Wanatabe. This is a drama fantasy horror film that is from Japan. It is currently sitting on a 7.9 on IMDb and a 4.1 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being a collection of four Japanese folktales with supernatural themes. So this is a movie that I learned about when I was, you know, getting early on into starting to seek out the origins of the horror genre. It appeared in the Fangoria Top 300 Horror Movies of All Time issue. It sounded interesting. I did remember that. So this one, it appeared on podcasts periodically that I listened to. So I also knew that this is beloved. You know, if not that, I knew I at least would enjoy, or it's mostly enjoyed by people, I guess to say. And I also kind of figured I would enjoy it as well. So what I'm going to say is I'm not sure if all these are folk tales that people from Japan would know or grow up with. They could also just be cautionary tales that tell different things that are common to stories across cultures. So I want to delve into this a bit more, though. I do know that they're presented, you know, in a Japanese way. So the first story is The Black Hair. This has an interesting aspect that I learned about through things with, like, The Grudge or The Ring. The second story is The Woman in the Snow. It feels like something we've seen before. Now, where that goes, I wasn't necessarily expecting, though. I didn't love it, but I also give credit for being different. Third story is Hochi the Earless, and then the last one is In a Cup of Tea. Now, these are ones that I think could translate elsewhere. It might take a bit of tweaking, but it could be done. That makes it work for me, since even I could connect with them not being Japanese. So getting back to something I said earlier, these stories are cautionary tales. The first one I laid out would be something that you are, you'll kind of be appreciate what you have and don't earn for things that you don't. You could read The Woman of the Snow as a tale about keeping your promises. I could even make the argument about not gossiping or telling tales as well. Hochi is the opposite. His is where his character ends up doing things that are heartwarming. He also dealt a raw deal with being blind. He also has something horrific happen during this story, but it still does what he thinks is right. As for the last one, I felt like a Twilight Zone episode, actually. I could say that is about keeping your cool despite things happening to you. Be patient. I could also be wrong about these, but that's just how I read them. So with that fleshed out, I want to go over to the best part of this movie, which is the cinematography. This movie is beautiful. The care and detail put into the shots are amazing. I caught myself looking at the backgrounds. Part of the time, I could consider this an art house film. The sets are also of the period the stories are set. That adds something as well. I'm going to have to transition over here to more of the filmmaking. I'd say the editing is good. I did have an issue, though, with the pacing. This runs too long. I think the stories drag on longer than they should. Trimming all of them could get this closer to 2.5 hours, where I think this runs tighter. Other than that, I think the effects we get are good. Being this is from the 1960s, they were practical or in camera. No issues there. Soundtrack also fit for what this movie needed. So all it's left to go into would be the acting. I'd say the performances were right there for what was needed. This is a large cast, so I'm not going to go through each one, but to credit to be people like Aratami, Wanatabe, I would also say Rentaro Mikuni, Tatsuya Nakadi, Keiko Kishi, Yuko Mokazuki, Katsuo Nakamura, Kanemon Nakamura, and Nobuar Nakaya as the standouts. If I mispronounce any of those names, I do apologize. There wasn't a bad performance, so I will give credit to that. So there's not much more I want to delve into here. I probably should have done a full review on this one, but in conclusion, this is an epic. The anthology features four stories that fit together well. I think the message behind them is good. How this is shot is amazing. The rest of the filmmaking is good as well. I just had issues with the length. Other than that, the acting is spot on. This won't be for everybody. If you like foreign films, this is a classic. I'd recommend this if you're into art house cinema, as I think you can appreciate this. And I would even say this for horror and non-horror fans alike. So my rating for Quieten is going to be an 8.5 out of 10. So what I'm going to go ahead and do is get you over to the trailer of my first featured review.
I don't know what's real anymore. I know I made a terrible mistake.
Means a lot that you came. Just give the old man a chance. Karen, his only grandkid. It's good to see you, Dad.
To new beginnings. To life. What happened?
It's a suicide.
I may have found something.
It's on the knife.
It's an ancient warding inscription. Often to seal a body containing a demon. But in today's world, who has the know-how to play with this kind of stuff?
And what if someone did?
Misery, taker of children. It'll make you see things, feel things that aren't real. Whatever it takes to get what it wants, a child inside that sigil.
And for my first featured review here is going to be The Offering. This is from 2022, but it's getting its wide release this year. This is directed by Oliver Park. It was written by Hank Huffman. This stars Paul Kaye, Nick Blood, and Emily Wiseman. And this also is featuring Alan Cordner, Jonathan Uger, Veselvar Benev, Daniel Ben-Zeno, Anton Tredafilvo, Nathan Cooper, Bonyan Anev, Jody Jacobs, Sophia Weldon, and Yanko Dimitrov. This is a horror film that is from a co-production of the United States, United Kingdom, and Bulgaria. This is currently sitting on a 5.6 on IMDb and a 2.6 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, a family struggling with loss finds themselves at the mercy of an ancient demon trying to destroy them from the inside. So this was a movie that I didn't know much about, but I saw it was playing at the Gateway Film Center and that it was horror. That was enough for me to make it a point to go to the theater to check this one out. And I thought it would make an interesting double feature here on this pairing with Rituals. And, you know, I've kind of already gotten into this, but, you know, this one actually has some rituals in it. There's a different type of de facto one in that other movie. So, yeah, that's the double feature that I was using here. But before I get into the movie itself, let me do some featured notes. And I'll start with our director of Park. He has 5 credits. All are in genre. He has 2 shorts that are called Vicious and Still. His feature film debut for this genre and in general was Strange Events. I had not heard of any of those. I did hear about another one he did, or at least did a short in of A Night of Horror, Nightmare Radio. Not seen it though. This is the only one so far. And then for our writers, I'll start with Uger. This is his feature film debut, and the same for Hoffman, his co-writer, who I believe came up with a story. I actually have that backwards. Uger came up with the story, and then Hoffman wrote the screenplay. Then moving over to our cast, I'll start with Kay. He has 51 movies, and I've seen 5. I've seen him in Shaun of the Dead, Dracula Untold, Anna and the Apocalypse, and The House, as well as this one here. The only one that I haven't seen is something called, I don't know if it's Vaz or if it's W Delta Z from 2007. Then his co-star of Blood has 10 works. This is the only one that I've seen. He does have 3 in horror. His first was something called Exmoor from 2014. Then he was in this, and he's attached to something upcoming called Lovely Dark and Deep. Now next is Wiseman, and she has 4 films. I've seen 2. Both are in horror, with the first one being Winchester before being in this. Last, I'll also look, though, at Cordier. He has 67 credits, and I've seen 3. Out of horror, he was in Gladiator and Fred Claus. In genre, he has 3. The first was a comedic take on Burke and Hare with Simon Pegg and Andy Serkis. He was also in A Ghost Story for Christmas, Count Magnus, from last year. So for this one here, we start in the house of Yosel, portrayed by Treta Filvo. Now, background information is that his wife has passed away. He did a ritual to see her, and this causes Sarah Scheindendahl, who is portrayed by Weldon, to visit him. He is trying to do a binding ritual, but it ends up killing him in the end, as we know that Sarah might not be this little girl, like the ghost of her, or might be actually be something much more dark there. So the movie shifts over to Arthur, portrayed by Blood, and his wife Claire, portrayed by Wiseman, going to visit his father of Saul, portrayed by Cordner. Tensions are high from the last time they visited. The reason is that Claire isn't Jewish. Art has distanced himself from the faith as well. They are there as Art needs his father to sign a document so he can use his house as collateral for a business deal. So Art is struggling at work and he's hiding it from his wife. Things are much different than they were expecting. Saul has relented since the last visit. He is elated to see them. Part of this is that Claire is carrying his first grandchild. Saul's friend and co-worker of Hamish, portrayed by Kay, also comes around and he doesn't trust Art. Now, I should also point out that Saul runs a funeral home, and it's a definite, like, a Jewish funeral home. It is done in the basement and the front room of his house. Yosel is brought in, and Art agrees to help his dad. So Saul gets pulled away by Hamish, so Art starts. He finds a knife in the man's chest and an odd stone around his neck. Art removes the knife and a pendant. He drops the ladder, though, and it cracks. He is worried, so he slides it down the drain as he doesn't want to get in trouble for some reason. So Saul returns and notices the knife. It makes him concerned with the markings that are on it. He thanks Art and has him go to bed. So the worry causes Saul to reach out to an expert on Jewish lore by the name of Levi Shigelman, portrayed by Uger. He runs a bookstore from what I'm gathering. Saul relays what he knows and Levi puts his fears to ease. The older man doesn't know about the stone though. Levi tells him not to worry about a demon inhabiting the body, they just cannot burn it, so that would end up releasing it. So some supernatural things start to happen here. Art and Claire both see things, Saul encounters something much worse. The entity does what it can to get free and entices this young couple. We also learn one other thing about the demon, it is a taker of children. So that's where I'm going to leave my recap introduction to the characters. Where I want to start is that I did a quick search on the name of the demon, which is Abazo. And it seems to be real. That was actually going to be the original title of this movie as well. I love this idea. I'm a sucker for mythology, especially when it's something that I don't know about. So apparently, though, this isn't the first movie that I've seen that features this creature. I've seen The Possession from 2012, which has it in there. And there they also refer to it as Debuk. And then Slenderman also briefly shows it. Now, I have not seen that movie. But this is a female demon normally that is blamed for miscarriages and infant mortality. That should give an interesting idea of what we're getting here and what it wants. So as a new parent, this was effective. Then going from this, I think this works with having built in the mythology that it does. The movie also introduces the information that you need to know. So if you don't know the entity coming in, it doesn't hinder you. It then uses just the imagery. I love the look of the entity. They go CGI with it, but I'm not sure doing it practical would help anything or would necessarily work better. The form they use is in line with our idea of Satan. It is a goat-like creature. They also hide it where we're seeing parts of it and it doesn't linger too long. I'll give credit to the cinematography here as well. So with what they set up here, there is a human story between Art, Saul, and Claire. It isn't as complicated one that we've not, I mean, it's something we've seen before. And it doesn't have to be necessarily either. Hamish believes that Art is there for a reason, which he's right. I do also believe that Art is there for his father though. He wants him to be part of his soon-to-be granddaughter's life. Art just has an ulterior motive as well. I believe how they progress the story is good. It also adds something that happens to Saul, and it gives Hamish a reason to be mad. I believe the next thing I should go over to the acting. They are solid across the board here. Blood is good as this guy who is proud and wants to get back on his feet. He has a plan, but he's out of his control. That makes him seem shady and works in the framework. Wiseman is good as his wife. I like what they do with her as she finally befriends Saul. Cordner is good there. I like Kay as his friend. He's also a bit of a jerk, but he's doing what he does because he doesn't trust Art. Other than that, I liked Uger, Trendafilov, Weldon, and the rest of the cast as well. So there's not much more that I can go into here. Just some couple things here with the filmmaking. There aren't a lot in the way of practical effects. I've already said what they did with this entity is, you know, done with CGI, and it doesn't look bad. There were moments that also use CGI as well. Not all of it looked good, but none of it ruins the product either. I just prefer practical when it can be used. The other thing is the soundtrack. I love the chanting of prayers and the different things there. That adds element to the movie for me. The entity is also creepy in how it sounds and what it's able to do, so that's also good. So there wasn't any other trivia that I've already shared or found, so what I'm going to go ahead and do is that, in conclusion, this is a movie that I didn't know anything about coming in aside from the title. That works for me with the exploration of the creature and the use of religion that I'm not versed in. We get dark subject matter with this entity and what it needs. I thought that the acting was good. This is well made. They go CGI with the demon, but that's not necessarily a bad thing. There are effects that don't look great. Not enough to ruin this, though. I would say that this would make a good double feature with The Vigil. If you've seen that, I think you will like this as well. I'd recommend giving this one a viewing, though. So my rating is going to be a bit high just because this does tick boxes for me and with things that I like. So for The Offering, I have this as an 8 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section, so let me get you over to the trailer of my second featured review.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise.
If you go down in the woods today, you're sure of a big surprise.
This animal has only been dead for a couple of hours.
Look, Harry, somebody's playing a very sick game with us, and I want to know who, and I want to know why.
If you go down in the woods today, you better go in disguise.
April's dead, Harry.
Was it a man?
For every man that ever there was will gather there for certain
makeup.
Today's the day the
teddy
bears have their
pig. We're in the middle of nowhere, Mitzi. No one's gonna help us.
Why? Why is it happening to us?
Somebody has stolen that boots!
Why would anyone steal five pairs of boots?
Get off it, DJ.
Look! 2 months ago, I sent everyone Xerox sheets of what I would supply and what you were to bring. You were to bring extra shoes and your toothbrushes. I supplied everything else.
Five doctors on their annual ritual, just trying to have a good time. But this is the year they should have stayed at home. Rituals isn't a picnic. You're in for a big surprise.
And for my second featured review is going to be Rituals. This is from 1977. This was directed by Peter Carter, written by Ian Sutherland. It stars Hal Holbrook, Lawrence Dane, and Robin Gamble. This also features Ken James, Gary Reinecke, Murray Westgate, Jack Crelly, and Michael Zenon. This is an adventure horror thriller film that is from Canada. It is currently sitting on a 6.2 on IMDb and a 3.4 on Letterboxd, with the synopsis being, five doctors on a wilderness outing are stalked by a disfigured, crazed killers. So this is a movie that, I'll be honest, I had heard about and put on a list of ones to check out from podcasts. I didn't remember anything about it, though. This popped up when I was using a randomizer for what to watch as part of my New Year New Movies here on the podcast. So seeing the cast really pulled my interest, especially because I didn't know a whole lot about it. So let me get over to talking about some of these people, and I'll start with our director of Carter. He has helmed 8 movies. This is the first that I saw. This was also his first in horror. He also did another one called The Intruder Within from 1981 that I had not heard of. Then to the writer of Sutherland, it looked like he had 3 total. He collaborated again with this director on a movie called High Point. Only one he did in horror, though, and that I've seen. So then moving to our cast, I'll start with a legend of Hal Holbrook. He did a whopping 121 movies, to which I've seen 8. Out of horror, I've seen Men of Honor, The Majestic, and Promised Land. In horror, he did 5, and I've seen 4 of them. I've seen The Fog, Creepshow, Girls' Night Out, and now this. The only one that I haven't yet is The Unholy from 1988. Then to his co-star of Dane, I've seen 3 of his 57 films. All that I've seen are in horror. His first was The Clown Murders, which I had not heard of. He was also in this and Scanners. I've also seen Bride of Chucky. I have not seen from him, though, is Happy Birthday to Me, Of Unknown Origin, Dark Man 2, or Behind the Wall. And lastly, I'll look at Gamel. He has 52 works, and I've seen 3. He was in Austin Powers, which I had no idea, and he was also in Skyline, and I've seen both of those. His first, though, in genre was The Pix, and then this. He was also in The Haunting of Julia, a Wait Until Dark remake from 1982, which I didn't know about, Murder by Phone, Nightmares, Inhumanoid, and Bone Daddy. So then for this movie here, we actually start with seeing a plane land in water. And we kind of see that this is a bit of a remote area. It then cuts over to a local restaurant where we have these 5 doctors from our synopsis are eating. One is given his pitch to sell a procedure that increases the blood flow to a man's penis. They point out the flaws to it, and we see that they're quite loud. The doctors are Harry, portrayed by Holbrook, Mitzi, portrayed by Dane, Martin, portrayed by Gamel, Abel, portrayed by James, and DJ, portrayed by Reinecke. They went to medical school together, where they all became friends. Should also be pointed out, though, that Marty and DJ are brothers. Then they head out via seaplane to go fishing. The pilot informs them that it's difficult to get in and out of this area, so if they need to, he won't be back until a certain time in this area. So DJ is the wilderness guy who planned this trip. He's annoyed that no one followed what he told them to bring, and nobody's really prepared besides him. Marty is no longer a practicing surgeon, choosing to go into general medicine. That's a little bit of just background info that you need. He's also gay. And then we have Harry, who's a neurologist, and Mitzi is a surgeon. So the group hikes into the woods, and that first night, things don't go well. They drink, and we see that there is pent-up animosity amongst them. Each one seems to take different things to heart. They also take shots at each other. The following morning, they notice that all their boots are gone. This is unnerving as they wonder who could have taken them. DJ elects to hike to a nearby dam for help. Now things get even more odd from there. They find a deer's head with a snake coiled around the spine. This resembles a logo for medicine, which I had learned in writing this review of it is called the Catagus. Now everyone except Marty believes that DJ did it. They decide to hike to the dam after him. Even more odd things happen as they find booby traps and seem to be hunted by someone hiding in the woods. What I questioned is, are they really being hunted, or is DJ the one messing with them, having hit his limit with the group? So that's really my recap and introduction to the characters. Where I want to start is that this feels like a clone of Deliverance, or at the least, highly inspired by it. I don't mean that as a bad thing, though. It just shows to me that when something is successful, you'll get different variations on it. The similarities of having these like city people go out into the wilderness, they're all doctors here. Deliverance had them as successful men who are professionals, but that was about the extent I believe. Now they also must traverse the elements while being chased. So with that established, what is interesting about the feel of this movie is that it comes off almost like a slasher. Our characters are picked off one by one. I wouldn't say that it's done in the traditional sense though. There would have been proto-slashers out already, but Halloween wouldn't come out until the following year. There were traps that were used. I do have a problem here as well. The differences of our characters cause them to separate, allowing them to be attacked. That does feel a bit off to me, but then again, that's how slashers work as well. This doesn't necessarily ruin anything, but it's something I noticed because, I mean, in my opinion, you wouldn't necessarily know, especially when people start to get attacked. I don't think you would separate even over petty differences. So I should say here that I'm not going to spoil this movie. The reason that the killer or killers are coming after them is interesting. They know that they are a group of doctors. The group starts to think of someone who might come after them for something they've done. You know, like malpractice or something. Things get revealed as we go, and it works for me. It is an idea that is still relevant today, and we've seen similar ideas in modern horror. So I think I'm going to go over next then would be the acting. First, I'll say that this group of 5 are great. They act like characters who have known each other for so long. Now, the little things set them off, and that feels real. Holbrook is great as our leader. Not so much in his survival concepts, but just the strongest overall guy. Dane is funny to me because he's so annoying. Gamble as good as Marty. I found it interesting that he was a gay person. It doesn't bother this group, which makes it progressive for 77. James is solid, as is Reinecke. This latter guy is a survivalist of the group. Other than that, I thought that the rest of the cast rounded us out for what was needed. Special credit to Creeley, who is Jesse, and Xenon, who is Matthew. Now, all that I have to go into would be with the filmmaking, besides some trivia. We don't get a lot in the way of effects, but what we do are good. They went practical. This might also be the time that it came out. The effects look solid, though, so I have to give credit. I love the setting. It's isolated, so anytime someone gets hurt, it amplifies the difficulty. It also raises the stakes. Cinematography was also good. That helps with the atmosphere. I also think the soundtrack and design of this are also solid. So in for some trivia here. This was shot in continuity. The severed deer's head was real. The film's wilderness setting, The Cauldron of the Moon, was shot in a stretch of Ontario wilderness that had been burned out by a forest fire 5 years earlier. Plenty of the charred trees left from the fire can still be seen. The original script left the killer's identity unknown. The scene with the guys trudging through the swamp was shot in a single take. The cabin was a leftover building from the Canadian TV series Forest Rangers from 1963. Everything else was a practical location. The movie was re-released in 1982 under the title Creeper, or The Creeper, on Siskel and Ebert's TV show. It is chosen by Gene as a dog of the week, but Gene was mostly interested in whether the movie was released before, and if so, under what title. Hundreds of readers then wrote to him and Roger to answer that the film was from 1978 and called Rituals. The film's killer was played by the second assistant director, Xenon. This was shot in 76, but didn't see an American release until 78. Gamble did his own stunts in the river sequence. Holbrook's salary was roughly 1/6 of the film's budget. Jeez. The doctors entered the woods by train in an earlier draft of the script. Holbrook and Dane were the only co-starring film together. Amazon Prime Video description says this movie was released in 2021, but it was actually released in 77. And then a death later in the movie with fire was done with mirrors, which is kind of a cool thing to think about. So then in conclusion here, this is a solid little film. It is one that I hadn't heard of outside of those podcasts that brought it up, but I didn't remember anything they said. I like this idea of our group of doctors getting together and going on this trip. They get out in the middle of nowhere and it becomes a fight for survival. The story is one that we've seen before while still feeling different. The acting is the strongest part. This is also well made, and I enjoyed my time with it. If you like movies like this, I'd give this a go. And I mean that for horror and non-horror fans alike. So my rating here for Rituals is going to be a 7.5 out of 10. Not going to do a spoiler section here, as I don't really think there's anything else I need to delve into. So let me get you over to one last break before I close out the show. I would like to welcome you back, and then just to close everything out here, if you'd like to send me an email with any sort of feedback or anything that you'd like to have read on the show, you can send me that email at journeywithacinephile@gmail.com. If there's anything that you send me you don't want read on the show, just let me know in that email. If you'd like to read any of the reviews from anything on this episode or any of the past episodes, that's horrorreview.webnode.com. If you'd like to become friends with me on Facebook, I'm David Mishkin Garrett Jr. On Twitter, I'm Buckeye from Mish. Letterboxd, I'm David OSU. And over there, I'll be posting all of the reviews of anything that I'm watching that is horror or non-horror alike. If you'd like to follow my Instagram page, that's David OSU87. If you'd like to follow the Journey with a Cinephile Instagram, that's Journey with a Cinephile, all one word. What I will be posting over there is, on both of them, the movie posters of anything that I am reviewing. And if you follow my personal one, every now and then you might see some personal pictures if I ever post any, because I tend to forget while I'm out and about. And just to make it easier on you, I'll have all of those links in the show notes. And then the last thing I'd ask you to do is that whatever podcatching device you're listening to me on, if you could go ahead and hit subscribe so you never miss a new episode, that would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you're able to rate and review just so I can figure out what I'm doing that you like and what I'm doing that you don't like, as well as to get out to more listeners out there as well. And then for my next episode, I wasn't sure what my 2023 release was going to be. I end up deciding on watching Sorry About the Demon. I don't necessarily know if this makes the greatest pair up with the randomizer movie that was selected, which is Sorority House Massacre. I guess you could kind of say there's a bit of comedy mixed in with both of these. And I mean, I haven't finished watching this 2023 film as of yet, so we will see, and you know, I'll do what I can here. I will also watch another Traverse Through the Threes movie. I believe it's actually The Invisible Man from 1933, and I'll watch more horror movies on top of that. I don't necessarily know if there's anything else I need to get to speed with here in this outro, so I will say once again, thank you so much for listening. And whatever you do today, I hope you're safe and doing it. Have a great time out there. This is your tour guide of David Garrett Jr., and I am signing off.
It had been a wonderful evening, and what I needed now to give it the perfect ending.